Hi, this is Paula Moreau, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. Leave,
and he says the Bible tells him who he can and cannot hate. Then he promises redemption with the passing of the plate. Well, as Simon Peter met this man, you know he'd still be at his net. Locked behind, still on the back row, cause I ain't that angry yet.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Mark Curry? Do y'all like Mark? Mark Curry is a Little Rock singer-songwriter whose roots run through North Texas and Southeast Arkansas. More can be found at markcurry.com. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the Oyster Bar in the Stiff Station Capitol View neighborhood in Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by Temenos Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morell. On my right here playing for us tonight is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark can be heard on blues legend John Weston's CDs, Blues at Daybreak, and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These Delta screen doors with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection and are for sale. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and V.L. at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our stories all revolve around a turn of events that have our storytellers having to think quickly. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Emily Noah's travel accommodations keep her on her toes. And we'll end the night with Susie Branton, her three boys, and a time crunch. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Alan Reese and a news story that stuns him in 3 days.
Throughout his life, the older of my two sons has been unusually adventurous. We first witnessed this trait when he was 4 or 5 years old. We were preparing for a hike in a national forest. My wife and I were tightening boots and donning packs when we looked around and discovered he was gone. We searched frantically and found him 50 yards up the trail. He was marching along, head up, singing, clapping his hands, and as happy as you've ever seen a child. This adventurous nature appeared periodically during his high school years, but it began to gel when he was in college. At the end of his sophomore year, he announced that he had found a job for the summer. I was thinking tree trimmer, maybe waiter, but I was very, very wrong. He was going to live in a tent and work for a scientific research site atop a glacier in Greenland. During his remaining college years, he began leading other students and staff on canoe trips and backpacking trips. After graduating, he wandered west and worked as a whitewater raft guide and a forest firefighter, rappelling out of helicopters into deeply remote areas. He climbed the Grand Teton and Jackson Hole, and then found a way to work 2 or 3 seasons at McMurdo Station in Antarctica, where he spent time at the actual South Pole. With the money he earned, he sailed the Great Barrier Reef off of Australia, traveled South Pacific Islands, climbed the highest mountains in Ecuador and New Zealand. He went to Peru and reached Machu Picchu via a trail so remote and dangerous that the government required him to hire a guide before they would issue a permit. Eventually, he began to climb cliffs and stone pillars and mountain walls, and that was where I drew my line. He was forbidden to mention any of these new vertical adventures until after they were done. Most parents at times wonder where in the city their child is. We wondered at times where in the world ours was. I say all this partially bragging, of course, but mostly so you'll understand that we eventually learned to trust him, to trust his skills, his decision-making, and his common sense as he explored the world, and why we didn't worry when he announced that an equally adventurous friend were heading for Thailand to climb the cliffs around Phuket in December of 2004. That December, we returned to our hometown for the holidays. We stayed in a hotel, and on the 26th, I woke early, went to the lobby for a coffee, and drowsily watched the news. When colors began flashing and the grave voices of senior announcers took over, I began to pay attention. They spoke of an earthquake of record strength, a 300-mile-an-hour tsunami, massive destruction, casualties in the tens of thousands and counting. They spoke of Thailand and Phuket. There was a stunned, frozen feeling. I sat there trying not to personalize this news, but knowing that I must, thinking I needed to do something, but nothing would move. Finally, I went to wake my wife and confirm where we knew him to be, Phuket. That first day, everything became confusingly distant. We were very worried, but unsure how we should act. Friends and family asked and called, but we had no answers. We made it through social gatherings where our behavior varied between numb and frenetic. We just didn't know what to do or how to feel. The magnitude of this disaster was so big that it was impossible to assimilate, so we desperately fell back on our trust in him. But the truth was, my son and his friend were tiny dots amidst all that chaos. On the second day, I called the International Red Cross. A very sympathetic woman explained that the mass confusion and destruction were at that time blocking all but the most critical communications. She then told me very gently that the Red Cross made the calls we didn't want to receive, and she hoped we would not hear from her. That was when I began to come apart. By late afternoon, I was desperately clinging to an anesthetic numbness, but denial was becoming difficult. The horror of possibility, the horror of probability was becoming more and more palpable. Inevitably, the thought began to form and ring in my mind. It was far off and buried, and I struggled to suppress it, but it was relentless, and there was too much truth surrounding it to dismiss it. He's gone. I've lost my son. That night, we sat staring and relentless, restless, in my mother-in-law's living room. A silent television was turned to the local news. A black and white picture of him suddenly appeared. It was his senior prom picture. He was blessed with his mother's looks, dark hair, dark eyes, lean and tall, someone you would look at. He was wearing a tuxedo and looking calmly into the camera with a bit of a smile. The words missing in Thailand appeared at the bottom of the screen. Even now, I don't remember running out of the house. I do remember running, then walking, then running, then walking. I felt a tremendous urge to pound something, tear something, anything with my hands, and there were screams in me clawing to get out. But I wouldn't allow them out for the bizarre reason that I didn't want to scare anyone in the homes I was running past. I know I was coatless and very cold, though I don't remember it. I do remember a feeling of ice on my face. A phone in my pocket kept ringing. It was my wife, frantic to know where I was. I didn't know, but she found me. I remember the car was warm and suffocating, and I still wanted to scream. On the third day, we began the long drive back to Little Rock. It was morbid and silent and numb. Neither time nor thought existed for either of us. We were lifeless, moving mechanically, doing everything by rote and muscle memory. 1 mile north of the southern Missouri village of Jasper, my wife's phone rang. She answered and immediately began crying. She looked at me with her mouth open, but no words. She handed me the phone, and all I could hear was the mother of my son's friend saying over and over, "They're okay. They're okay. They're okay." I got the car off the road, and we were both hit with those long, racking sobs where your throat is paralyzed, your chest violently contracts, and your lungs forcefully, painfully expel all of their air, and your mind knows that something inside must surely break. When enough control returned, we drove into Jasper to a small diner where we began making calls, especially to our other son, miserably alone in Minnesota during all of this. When we finished, we found the owner at the cash register. We told him what had just happened and that we wanted to pay the tab for everyone in the diner. He smiled warmly and shook our hands. We left, but just as we got to our car, Everyone burst out of the diner and surrounded us, smiling, patting, shaking, touching, and congratulating. I will never forget that. There are two footnotes to this story. The first one is this. Both my son and his friend were trained in first responder techniques. They offered their services, but soon came to realize that the magnitude of the disaster demanded more than their skills offered, and that by staying, they would be using scarce food and water, best left to survivors. So in an astounding example of the resiliency of youth, they somehow acquired motorcycles and drove them to Angkor Wat in Cambodia. When he returned to the US, he flew into Denver. We went there to greet him. For reasons I don't recall, we met in a small bar and grill in the north part of the city. I sat on a bar stool, rigid, silent, unmoving, and unblinking, desperately staring at the door, all the while vowing I would not cry. When he walked in and smiled, it proved to be a short-lived and patently ridiculous notion. The second footnote is this. We all suffer emotional trauma in our lives. When it is new and raw, we deal with it in our way. For most everyone, time tends to soften the pain, to neutralize those vivid emotional colors that hurt. Time changes them to gray, puts them on white, then folds and folds, and places them in small alcoves in our minds. There they remain until we wish to remember or relate without reliving. This occurrence has resisted any normalcy for me. Despite the passage of years, those colors are still vivid and piercing. I have been unable to think of it without breaking down and have been nearly incapable of relating it aloud in any way. I began to wonder if I could tell this story in public, somewhat anonymously, if it might help dim those colors. I don't know if it'll work.
Alan Reese likes Sticky Ford Taverns, cheap red wine, big dogs, small towns, and is aging with as little dignity as possible. Next on Tales from the South, Emily Noah and her friend find a travel deal, but soon discover why it's so cheap in Staying with Steve.
Yeah, he has vinyl albums and maps on his wall. If you can't trust a guy who likes records and geography in his home, then who can you trust? Was the deep philosophical question posed by my best friend Jess as we searched a website looking for a stranger's home to sleep in. We were in the midst of planning a summer trip to Chicago for a music festival, and as very poor recent college graduates, we decided to explore the possibility of an online lodging website. The website, as I described to friends, was one step above couch surfing, one squeaky, broken, terrifying step. For the low price of roughly $20 a night each, Jess and I's temporary home would be Chicago resident Steve's modest guest bedroom in his apartment located in the Wicker Park area of the city. Steve met all the requirements. Great price, cool-looking apartment, an L public transportation station nearby, free Wi-Fi and parking, safe neighborhood, and bonus, he was wearing a really great hat in his profile picture. As Jess and I thoroughly read the description page of his home, we arrived at the guest requirements section, a space where hosts can clearly state any expectations for guests upon their arrival. Steve's guest requirement was simple and profound. Be cool. And with that, Jess and I knew this was a match made in heaven and booked our four-night stay. The next few months proved difficult for me as I excitedly talked to close friends about how much I was looking forward to the Chicago trip, and they would inevitably always ask, "Where are you two staying?" Jess and I became professionals at defending our decision. "It's actually so much cheaper than a hotel. All the hosts have to be certified by the website, so it's like really legitimate. It's like staying at a hostel in Europe. America is finally getting progressive. You just get a really realistic local perspective that you wouldn't if you were staying in a hotel, you know?" Our efforts failed miserably, and the majority of our friends replied with statements like, "Please text me frequently so I know Steve isn't actually serial killer Steve," and "Send me the address so I can tell Chicago PD where to find your bodies." Jess and I made a pact immediately after our booking confirmation that we were not going to tell our parents. After we made a safe arrival back to Arkansas, then, and only then, would our parents know about our new friend Steve. By some miracle, in the 3 months since I originally shared the Chicago plans with them, my mother and father had successfully avoided asking me the direct and dreaded, "Where are you two staying?" question. That is, until the night before our departure. I was enjoying a nice dinner with my parents when my mother finally asked, "Are you just staying with a friend or in a hotel?" I broke a sweat, took a deep breath, and chose the truth. Actually, neither. And as I explained my future stay with Stranger Steve, my father let out the longest disapproving sigh I ever heard him produce and only looked up from his meal to stare at the ceiling. I figured he had to be dramatically rolling his eyes or asking God why he chose to give him an idiot for a daughter. My mother let out a defeated, "Well, I know I can't stop you, so whatever. Just please call. Emily Grace, please call." Despite all the negativity, Jess and I gladly began our journey to Chicago. While on the road, I texted Steve informing him what time we would be arriving that afternoon. When we hit the city limits, Steve told us he was going on a run, then he would meet us at his apartment. Jess and I quickly parked about 2 blocks away and grabbed our suitcases. As we took in beautiful Chicago and walked down the busy streets with the loud noise of our suitcases rolling behind us, we jokingly whispered, "Is that our Steve?" about every jogger we passed. With each step we took, Jess and I began to give each other a few nervous glances mixed in with nervous laughter. Then about a block away, we could see Steve arrive at his doorstep and take a seat on his stoop. This is about the time Jess and I entered into full panic mode. We did not stop walking, but we did start whisper screaming at each other. "Em, why the hell did we decide to do this? We could have stayed at a Hampton Inn like every normal American." "Jess, we are the stupidest people I know. Is there really no one in our lives that loves us enough to stop us from doing this?" Steve then spotted us and gave us a friendly wave. We smiled and waved back while Jess managed to say, "This is how we die," through her grinning teeth. We arrived at the stoop, and after awkward small talk, Steve led us up to his place. So far, so good, but Jess continued to stare at me behind his back with a look that clearly told me she might murder me before he ever tried to. We walked into the living room, and Steve showed us to our room and gave us the quick tour. He was friendly and laid back, and when he gave us a key to come and go as we please, he told us, "If you see my landlord in the hallway, you're my cousin." Noted. It was then, just as our concerns were dying down, that the door unlocked and a man in a suit and fedora who looked to be in his 50s walked in. Steve introduced us to him quickly, and the man began to tell Steve all about his adventures from the day in very long-winded detail. Jess and I put the clues together. We thanked Steve for our warm welcome and went to the guest bedroom. We shut the door behind us and the whisper screaming began again. "Em, did you know there were other people staying here at the same time as us?" "Jess, no, the website failed to mention that." "Well, crap, no wonder this was so cheap." We brushed it off, changed quickly, received a few directions from Steve, and went on to explore Chicago. The next morning, Steve was already gone for the day when Jess and I started ours. So naturally, we took our time snooping around the apartment and discussing his book collection while we ate breakfast. I walked to the third bedroom where apparently the fedora-wearing long-winded talker had been staying, but Steve told us the night before he'd be gone by morning. The door was open, and as I peeked my head in to observe the room, yet another stranger was staring back at me. After my pulse went back to normal, he introduced himself and told me and Jess he was in town for a work conference. On our way into the city, Jess and I talked about our wild aspirations to one day attend work conferences and make enough money to stay at a prestigious La Quinta. The rest of the trip remained the same, always unlocking the door, never knowing what new face was going to be brushing his or her teeth in the bathroom. On our last night, Jess and I were exhausted and pathetically picked up questionable sushi from Walgreens. A South African woman was staying the night while in town for a friend's wedding. Jess and I quietly ate our sad sushi at the table while having to listen to a sad American strangely, sadly explain the American government to this poor woman in the living room. A high school freshman with 1 week of civics class would have done a finer job. The next morning, Jess and I packed our bags, left a note thanking Steve for his sweet hospitality, and slipped our key under the door as we left. We agreed on the way home that Steve might need to enforce a stricter policy on his be cool guest requirements.
A native of Little Rock, Arkansas, Emily Noah is a graduate student in the public history program at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. You can usually find her covered in dog hair and attempting to be funny on Twitter. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Susie Branton is tight on time when her son says something that stops her cold in Suck It Pinterest.
On Tuesdays, Aiden has art club after school. Then after that, all three boys have parkour class. And whatever you do, do not call it gymnastics class because it's not, okay? It's totally different than gymnastics. We have this teeny tiny window of 45 minutes to pick him up, get food down all three of their throats, and get everyone to the gym across the river in time to change and warm up. This is about as easy as getting Apollo 13 back to Earth. Yesterday was no different. Plus, I was running 15 minutes late. Julian had been sick from school, but well enough for parkour. Funny how that happens. Seth was upset because I was late, and Aiden was starving to death. And why couldn't we just run home really quick to get some food, please? I always think that I'm going to plan ahead for Tuesdays and pack a healthy snack for them before gymnastics. I mean parkour. I picture bento boxes with fruit arranged like flowers or a robot, miniature carrots with a homemade dipping sauce made with something like tahini, organic lunch meat with goat cheese. Of course, my kids would never actually eat any of that, but it would make me feel so good and clean. I think of Pinterest and how everything in my life is the exact opposite of something you'd see on Pinterest. I eye the floorboard of my car and I see gum wrappers, stickers from the pediatrician that we saw before Christmas, someone's homework that never made it into the house, a sock. I think about how brightly colored shelves or cubbies or hooks or crates might change my life forever and ever. I long for order. 5 minutes later and they're all whining, "We're hungry, Mom," in various pitches of pitiful from the back seat. Oh, we hadn't even made it to the bridge. I can't imagine how hungry they must actually be. Growing boys can be scary when they aren't fed. I've witnessed this many times, and many times I've feared for my safety. So I pulled into a drive-thru. I won't tell you which one because you'd be horrified. But suffice to say that pink slime, ampicillin, and E. coli were all on the menu. We indulged in all three, and it was delicious. Suck it, Pinterest. This was a matter of self-defense. At gymnastics, we had 5 minutes to eat this food stuff that I'm positive was cheaper than the packaging it came in. It was absolutely no problem since it seemed that no one had eaten since 2012. Whenever anyone messes up an order in our family, it's always Aiden's order. And that's probably best, because he is the best-natured of any of us. He is always saying things like, "Oh, that's okay. They were probably just busy." Or, "No, Mom, don't complain, please. I'll just eat this garden salad with no dressing." He's either very sweet or terrified that I'm going to embarrass him. So this time, he got the girl's toy in the boy's meal. He pulled it out, examined it with a confused look on his face, and then quietly said, "Mom, look." It was a light pink stuffed heart that had the word "love" stitched on it in lime green. It looked like a carnival prize. There was a card attached so that you could write to and from on it and give it to somebody for Valentine's Day. At first, I was about to do what I normally do, which is to go into a whole exaggerated act about the injustice of all of this. How dare they give you the wrong toy? We ought to call that restaurant. No, no, no. Let's call headquarters. Let's talk to the CEO. Let's get that place shut down. It snaps them out of their disappointment and makes everyone laugh. But then I remembered Noelle, a girl that Aiden has a baby crush on in class. I stopped and gave him that knowing look. He understood and whispered, "Noelle?" And I said, "Yeah." He looked back at the heart, then at me, and said, "No, I'd rather give it to you." Suddenly, all of the oxygen was sucked out of the room. Time stood still. I could hear the pat-pat of the ketchup dripping off of his French fry. I felt like I was floating. At that moment, this child could have asked me for anything, anything in the entire world. "Mom, can I go to space camp next month?" "Of course you can, baby. I will work 6 nights a week for the rest of my life so that you can go to space camp every year." "Mom, I know I won't be old enough to drive for 7 years, but can we get a Porsche 911 just so I can look at it in the driveway until I get my license?" "Of course we can, chicken beak. I'll take out a second mortgage on the house today." He'd rather give it to me? Crazy drive-through, crabby, late, non-Pinterest mom? I looked at his hands, which were halfway between a kid's hands and a teenager's hands. I could see the tiniest bit of pudginess in his fingers, but they were also getting long and would soon be slender. I floated over to him, bent over, and smelled his hair, which was matted, and gave him a kiss on his head and reached in to hug him when he jerked away and yelled, "Mom, get off me, geez!" There were other kids around, and I had totally embarrassed him, but I didn't care. His brother started cracking up. His face got red. Their parkour coach promptly walked in and said, "Let's go," and clapped his hands 2 times. They ran out of the room and into the gym, leaving behind boxes, wrappers, straws, cups, half-eaten E. coli sandwiches, and in the middle, one stuffed pink heart that said love. I wanted to take a picture of the mess and post it on Pinterest, but I couldn't find my phone.
Susie Brenton is a freelance writer, solo mom of 3 raucous boys, a postpartum nurse and lactation consultant who lives by the skin of her teeth in Little Rock, Arkansas. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at the Oyster Bar in Little Rock, Arkansas. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by Temenos Publishing Company and the Midnight News Writing Workshops. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Dairy Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Arkansas Arts Council, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from all Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
I wrote this song a couple years ago for a friend of mine. Depending on when you knew him by a lot of different names. Some people knew him as Keith, some people knew him as Barry. But to me, he was always Doc. This is called Doc's Lament. Walking through this valley, Lord, I will not be afraid. When the darkness hides the sunlight, I will meet you in the shade. And when the wind blows cold and lonesome, and my feet will make no step, I may not find you in this bottom, no, no, but I know I'll find you yet. And if I run away from you, Lord, and my struggle to be free, called up yonder, would you still remember me? I still remember Sunday morning, singing hymns and breaking bread, and going underneath that water, and coming up to raise the dead. And I remember what I promised. I swore I'd follow Jesus every day. But a man can't follow what he cannot see, no, no, when he's forgotten how to pray. And if I run away from you, Lord, in my struggle to be free, when the road is cut, why will they lay me down and wait till I hear the angels singing? Oh, yeah, I hope it's not too late.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in Person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.